world is changing.
So keep up with Rob.
The Rob Snow Show returns on Rogers TV and City News. 101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
Yesterday it was reported in the Globe and Mail an update on the detention of the two Michaels, Michael Kohlberg, Michael Spavor, held as hostages by the Chinese government in retaliation for the detention of Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive. She's fighting extradition to the United States right now. And Bob Fife and Steve Chase reported in the Globe yesterday that our ambassador to China, Mr. Barton, Dominic Barton, spent 3 weeks in Washington in early April holding talks with senior American officials aimed at facilitating the release of the Canadian hostages. So let's get some reaction to some of this news from Charles Burton, senior fellow at the McDonnell Laurier Institute's Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad and a former counselor at the Canadian Embassy in Beijing. Good morning.
Good morning, Rob.
What do you think Mr. Barton was up to in Washington?
Well, you know, the whole thing, of course, is very, very weird and irregular.
Okay.
The idea that the government of Canada would pull the ambassador from, you know, accredited to China for many weeks and then send him to engage in diplomacy in a country to which he is not accredited over a long period. I mean, 3 weeks in Washington is quite a long time. Doing, we're not exactly sure what, but it appears trying to convince the Americans to come up with some means to effect the release of Meng Wanzhou. So the question really is whether the ambassador was, you know, assisting the Chinese regime in preventing Ms. Meng from being extradited to the Eastern District of New York State, where, you know, facing very serious charges of fraud, maybe she would go state's evidence and provide information about any relationship her company, Huawei, might have with Chinese military and security agencies. You know, one wonders also whether Mr. Barton, while in Washington meeting with the Department of Justice, might have other concerns, you know, because his company, McKinsey, when he was a senior official there, is facing some response over corruption scandals in South Africa and Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Ukraine.
Okay.
You know, we just don't know. And I
but
feel
strange. You think it's all strange, Charles? You think it's strange?
Yeah, I just don't understand. You know, if Mr. Trudeau felt that Global Affairs Canada and the Canadian Embassy in Washington was not doing an adequate job in representing our concerns over Kohlberg's favor, you know, why wouldn't he appoint, say, a special envoy on this? Why would he pull the ambassador out, who was then not present in China when Kohlberg's favor had their trial? You know, that's when we first noticed that he wasn't there. And it just isn't consistent with his role as an ambassador to be engaged in this kind of activity, and I don't see the you know, I don't see the reason for it.
And why couldn't Canada's ambassador to the United States be working the diplomatic channels in the United States? That's strange too, right?
Yes, of course. I mean,
yeah,
it's,
okay.
It says something about Global Affairs and the ambassador that they feel that they're better off bringing in an ambassador accredited to another place. You know, but as I say, if they felt that they didn't have sufficient manpower in Washington, Mr. Trudeau could appoint a special envoy to pursue this matter alone. I mean, the bottom line is this is not that complicated. It's really a question of can the United States negotiate some kind of deferred prosecution agreement that would allow Ms. Yeah. Meng to return to China without facing jail time in the United States.
Yeah. And what do you think the likelihood of that is?
Very low. I mean, you know,
really?
Huawei is not prepared to acknowledge any culpability in the matter and pay a fine. I think they're hoping that the Canadian government will give in to pressure to terminate this extradition hearing before she gets to the States. And I would say I think that sending Mr. Barton there to negotiate with the American government, in effect on, you know, what could be seen as on behalf of the Chinese government, only emboldens the Chinese government to keep holding Mr. Kovrig in Mr. Faber for a longer period of time, as clearly that's working for them in terms of achieving their overall goal of getting Meng, not heading to the U.S. where she would have to testify under oath.
Okay. Why do you say it emboldens the Chinese regime?
Well, I mean, the message we would like to be sending to China is that their hostage diplomacy of Michael Kovrig and Michael Faber is bad for their overall international relations. And Canada, should be providing some sort of incentive to the Chinese regime to release them through sanctions or other measures that indicate to the Chinese government that hostage diplomacy has costs. What we've done instead is give the Chinese what they want from this political coercion, which is going to great measures to try and effect the release of Ms. Meng by getting the Americans to withdraw their charges against her or come up with some sort of plea bargain. So, if I was in Beijing, I'd be looking at it and saying, let's not release Kovrig and Faber anytime soon, because if we do that, then we won't have the Canadians pressuring the Americans over the Meng matter.
Okay. This was part of the reporting in the Globe and Mail yesterday. A source said Mr. Barton's overall mission was to, quote, convince the Biden administration to use its influence and garner support from other allies to persuade President Xi Jinping that China's global image is being badly tarnished as a result of Beijing's hostage diplomacy. Do you think the Chinese leadership cares that, or even believes that its global image is being tarnished?
Well, of course, the Kovrig and Faber hostage diplomacy is not the only one. I mean,
okay.
The Australian Fang Hongjun is also being held under similar circumstances, and one doesn't see the Canadian government standing up much to help out Australia in that regard. So I think certainly, the Chinese government recently, Mr. Xi made a speech complaining about how the propaganda work being done by Chinese diplomats and media outlets is not showing China as a lovable and credible and responsible member of the global community. So I don't think it's a question that China feels they should be doing anything differently, but that they should be somehow packaging it in a way which will cause public opinion not to fall to the kind of incredible lows that we're seeing with regard to Canadian support for our government's engagement with China, which is, down there sort of 10-15%, as opposed to most people thinking that we're not standing up sufficiently for our Canadian values and sovereignty and security. So I think from that point of view, the wolf warrior diplomacy and China's arbitrary use of non-tariff barriers to put economic pressure on places and this hostage diplomacy to try and influence our judicial process with regard to Ms. Meng is a policy that China finds is working for them. And the fact that, it causes people to, start squawking about how they're not abiding by the rules of the international rules-based order is clearly not having much impact on them. In other words, they know what's going on. We've told them this many, many times. I don't see that there's going to be anything but Canada actually making a substantive response to what China's doing to send out the message that there are costs to this kind
sure.
of behavior. But we have not done that over the 910 days that Kovrig and Faber have been held, and our government continues to say that their method of trying to get them out of their prison hell is the best one, and that they're working working behind the scenes and making progress. Well, 910 days is an awfully long time to be making extremely slow progress, as far as I can make out.
The U.S. Department of Justice has the power to withdraw the extradition request. What do you think the likelihood is of that?
I mean, virtually zero. I just don't see them doing that because they haven't so far. And, you know, in our own case, our Justice Department could also...
We're not going to do it.
And stop Justice Heather Holmes' careful consideration of the whether or not Ms. Meng qualifies under the extradition treaty. Mm-hmm. You know, neither side is prepared to give in to Chinese pressure in that way. I think with good reason, because it would then send the message to the Chinese authorities that if they behave in these appalling ways, that they can get what they want.
Okay. Thank you so much again, Charles Burton. Nice to hear from you again this morning.
Good to speak with you.
Yep. Take care. That is Charles Burton from the McDonnell Laurier Institute. Former counselor, Canadian Embassy in Beijing. Rob Snow Show, City News.
Firm.
Fair.
Fun.
The Rob Snow Show returns
on Rogers TV and City News, 101.1 FM
and 1310 AM.
It's called Building Back Better, the opportunities for businesses in a post-COVID Ottawa. And it's a new report based on surveys with hundreds of local business leaders in Ottawa. It's tracking their attitudes, their confidence in Ottawa's economy. And it's done by Welch LLP. It's called the Ottawa Business Growth Survey, and Welch's partners, Ottawa Board of Trade, Abacus Data, and the Ottawa Business Journal. And for more information on it this morning and how the outlook is looking, we're joined by Jim McConnery, Managing Partner, Welch LLP, Chartered Professional Accountants. Good morning, Mr. McConnery.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent.
Well, how's it look? What's the outlook?
Rob, it's improving, and that was a great outline of the survey you provided, but we've been doing the survey now for 7 years, so there's an interesting benchmark when we track the sentiment of the business community over a number of years, and one key aspect of the survey is a measurement of the business confidence index and, in general, how business leaders are feeling about the local economy. The benchmark would be 100, and we're always tracking how the business sentiment compares to that benchmark of 100. And not surprising, Rob, in the first 5 years of the survey, that business confidence index was always well above 100. It was as high as about 125 in 2017, and the notion that that business community is feeling pretty positive. And then not surprising, Rob, we did the survey last year. We're in the heart of the pandemic. The survey is running in March and April, and the business confidence index plummeted to 78. And
wow.
I think that was an accurate reflection of how the business community was feeling at that point in time. There was a lot of uncertainty about what the pandemic meant for business, what it meant for the outlook. And now, more or less a year later, doing the forecast in March and April 2021, we bounced back. So the business confidence index in 2021 was 103. So a great improvement over where we were last year, still not up to the high water mark we were a few years ago, but just really a sense of optimism, right, that we've presumably turned the corner. The worst is behind us. And when we look forward, things look relatively positive for the business community.
Good, good. Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about 2017 and everybody thinks back to Ottawa and Canada 150 and all the enthusiasm and La Machine is here and it's a big party. It was like the birthday party year.
Yes.
And the consumer confidence index for Ottawa, as measured by your firm, hits 125, and by the first half of the pandemic year, craters down to 78, but it has recovered significantly. So that's very good news.
Correct. A related takeaway, Rob, is the survey. We survey over 500 business leaders in the Ottawa economy, and we do break the survey down by sector. And not surprising, but definitely how you feel about where the economy is today and the outlook is highly dependent on the sector that the particular business is in.
Okay.
And that's the story, I think, of the pandemic, that it's affected so many businesses in different ways. So, for example, technology and construction have done relatively well over the last year. In some cases, businesses are doing better than they were in a pre-COVID environment. You know, and we think of Shopify as an example. And then other sectors of the economy, when we think about hospitality and retail, they've been hit so hard because the businesses in some cases have been shut down. So the business confidence is definitely positive when we think about where it is today, but there's definitely discrepancies depending on the sector of the economy. And I think that's been the story of the pandemic as well, Rob, that it's affected businesses in different ways. But ideally, those sectors of the economy that have struggled are also on track for improvement as things reopen as we move through 2021.
The whole remote work office centricity is dead. Speaking of Shopify, I'm wondering how that is revealed in your survey data.
It's a great question, and it's part of the survey in a few different ways, Rob. One question of business leaders is what they anticipate will be their need for office space as we move forward. And in particular, do business leaders see the need for office space shrinking, staying the same, or expanding? And it's relatively divided, Rob. There would be 30% of the survey respondents anticipate that they'll probably need less regular business or office space in the future. 25% see it growing and 40% see it staying the same. Whereas in a pre-COVID environment, I think you would have seen less of a preponderance of business leaders thinking that they'd have a shrinking office space environment because in a lot of cases, businesses anticipate growing. I think we're also at a point, Rob, where businesses are still trying to ascertain, you know, the impact of the pandemic, how it's changed the way we live and work and what it means on a go-forward basis. We'd be an example at Welch where we're sort of in that period of trying to evaluate what this means for us and our office space on a long-term basis. So for now, we'd probably say that it would stay the same.
Okay.
You know, we're probably not clear in our minds as to whether or not we'll see a smaller office footprint in the future. So I think things will play out over the next year or two.
I haven't seen some people in a year. It's pretty crazy, isn't it, to think about that? There are people who have not been to this building in a year.
That's right.
Have not even opened up their offices yet. So this idea that there were trends in place in business, in the workplace, digitization, the move to more, say, virtual commerce, this kind of thing, and that the pandemic accelerated all of these trends. Your business leaders that you surveyed, do they expect a deceleration or are we still pressing the accelerator in Ottawa? What do you think?
It's a good question. And I think business leaders are still in the midst of, you know, trying to ascertain what the changes that we've gone through in the last year mean in terms of work environment on a go-forward basis. I can imagine that some businesses are keen to get back to normal and to a certain extent being able to be back in the office, the work environment, the retail environment means that businesses will operate the way they did in the past. But I also think there is an opportunity to take advantage of some of the key changes that have happened over the last year. And I think some of that change, Rob, will come from an employee perspective as well, because employees, I think, in some ways have liked some of the benefits and some of the opportunities that have come from a different work environment. In some cases, that's maybe less commuting time, maybe more flexible schedules in terms of when people work. I think it's a bit of a juggling act from an employer perspective, a business perspective as to how you accommodate, you know, your customers, but also your workers, employees, and how and when they will want to work. And I think we'll get a better sense for that as things go forward. Yeah. One question we had in the survey was about how employees would plan to split their time in the future between home and office. 47% said they still anticipated being in a regular work office environment, whereas 49% said they probably prefer some opportunity to work at home at least part of the time. I don't think we asked that specific question in the past, but I'm sure that 49% of people wanting some opportunity to work from home is much higher than it would have been in prior years.
Okay. So on the mend, not quite back to normal, but very optimistic for the capital, right, Mr. McConery?
I think so, Rob.
Yeah.
And we're seeing good economic indicators overall. I think there's a lot of pent-up demand. You've had consumers who drive the economy have been on the sidelines now for an extended period of time. For some people, that means they've accumulated savings. They're maybe in a better financial position they were before the COVID. And I think that translates positively when we think about the business economy in Ottawa, when we think about that retail environment in Ottawa, that you've got a lot of consumers who personally are keen to be back in stores and restaurants. And I think that looks good for our local economy.
Great stuff. Jim McConnery, nice to hear from you with some good news about our local economy.
Rob.
Thank you again. Managing partner, Welch LLP, Chartered Professional Accountants. We'll be right back. Mr. Ford, Premier Ford, is expected to address the media about what happened in London, Ontario, Sunday. Any moment now, probably sometime around 11:30. So we'll join that as well, Premier Ford, with a brief statement. This is the Rob Snow Show on City News.
He's a pillar of community opinion.
The Rob Snow Show returns
on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM
and 1310 AM.
So as Sarah just mentioned, Prime Minister Trudeau, Premier Ford will attend a vigil tonight in London, Ontario for five members of a Muslim family. Police say they were the victims of a deliberate attack. The vigil is going to be outside the London Muslim Mosque this evening. Ford, Premier Ford, says the attack has left the province in mourning. Four people died, 9-year-old boy in hospital. And as a result, Premier Ford has said all government events are canceled today, and they're going to allow the family and the community to grieve. We brought you some of the speeches by the federal political leaders in the previous hour from the House of Commons here on the Rob Snow Show. But let's get a little bit more into the actual on-the-grounds in investigation and what would be involved in something like this. Phil Gursky is here. He's president, CEO, Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. Good morning.
Morning, Rob. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Well, been better, I suppose.
Yes.
I'm a native of London, Ontario.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, I'm born and raised, so it kind of hits home.
Wow. Wow. I didn't know that about you, Mr. Gursky.
Yeah.
So, that does hit close to homes. Boy, it's amazing that something like that could happen in London, Ontario. Ontario had four murders for the entire year last year.
No, you're right. But, you know, I want to remind your listeners that when I worked at CSIS, you know, from 2001 to 2015, we dealt with a serious terrorist attack that took place in Algeria, of all places, that was carried out in part by three Londoners, three high school students who actually had converted to Islam, become Islamist extremists, and went to Algeria and killed 41 people. So,
wow.
Yeah, London is not normally known for that. I agree with that. It was a safe town when I was growing up there.
Right.
And it is it's a disheartening, horrific, cowardly crime that was committed. And I think it strikes all of us as, you know, what a wanton, unnecessary waste of life by this young man for reasons yet to be determined, I suppose.
Yeah. So suspected hate crime, London police say terrorism charges might be laid. Do you think this would rise to the level of a terror attack? Federal politicians use the term, it was an act of terrorism, a terrorist attack today. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I heard the Prime Minister just say that. And my first question is, what does he know that I don't know and that you don't know? Because not a lot of information has been made public. No, fair enough, Rob. He's the Prime Minister. He might have access to intelligence that I no longer have access to. But all we know is that it was deliberate. London police have said it was premeditated, which suggests first-degree murder. They suggested he targeted them because they're Muslim, which suggests a hate crime. Does not suggest terrorism at this point, because a hate crime is not a terrorist crime necessarily. The two are not the same thing. They're not synonymous. And, you know, for terrorism charges to be laid by the Crown, there has to be a really strong link between a political, ideological, or religious motivation. And I'm sorry, we just don't know that just yet. So I think people are conflating hate with terrorism. They're not the same. It may turn out to be that way. But I don't know, again, unless there's information that they have that I don't have, I can't get there just yet. And if it's determined that he did this because he, you know, subscribed to right-wing extremist websites and he was a member, I got no problems with terrorism. I'm just saying that as of noon on, you know, June the 8th, we don't know that just yet.
Okay. This is what the Prime Minister said in the House of Commons in the last hour or so, Phil Gursky. Let's listen to this together here.
Assalamu alaikum. Lately, a lot of Canadians have been enjoying evening walks to get a bit of fresh air after long days at home during this pandemic. on Sunday in London, Ontario. That's what a grandmother, two parents, and two children went out to do. Three generations of the Afzul family. Salman, Madia, their children Yumna and Fayaz, and their grandmother. But unlike every other night, that family never made it home. Their lives were taken in a brutal, cowardly, and brazen act of violence. This killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack motivated by hatred in the heart of one of our communities.
Okay, so no accident. You heard him there, a terror attack. What would you like to know now, Phil Gursky, if you're law enforcement right now, or if you're part of the intelligence apparatus in the country? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to figure out right now?
What was in his mind when he did this? How long had he been thinking about it? London police suggest it was premeditated. You may have seen, Rob, that he was arrested with some kind of an armored vest, which suggests he was preparing for some kind of shootout, perhaps, with law enforcement, although he was arrested without incident, as far as I can tell. You know, again, when we're talking terrorism, it's a very specific thing under the criminal code. I mean, there are hate crime provisions under the Canadian criminal code. That's a separate section of the code. And, you know, and judges have the authority and the leeway when talking about this. If you commit a crime and it turns out you commit it for hateful reasons, the judges can actually increase your sentence. That's what the criminal code says. But, you know, unless the suspect comes out and definitively says, I did this because of X, Y, or Z, or they find something on his laptop or his iPhone or whatever, where he has said something online or post something online, we can't make that leap just yet. The fact that this was a terrifying incident, and by all means it was, does not mean it was terrorism. I understand the emotional appeal behind this. I understand the desire to want to call it this.
Okay.
But as a guy that spent 32 years in intelligence, I need to see something more concrete.
Like what?
Well, again, you know, did he belong to a group? Did he subscribe to an ideology? Did he post things online? Was he part of a network of people that believed this way? Did he follow certain people? Was he radicalized by somebody who had these views? That's what determines terrorism, not the fact that, you know, it was a heinous act of violence that appeared to target an ethnic group. There's lots of hate crimes in this country, Rob. They're not necessarily acts of terrorism. They're cowardly acts of violence, but they're not necessarily acts of terrorism.
Okay.
So that, I hate to be dogmatic here, Rob. But I mean,
No. That's fine. From an investigative point of view, there you would think law enforcement now, they're in his apartment, they're going through all of his electronic devices, his correspondence. There, they want to know his entire probably electronic history, right?
Yeah. And they're also probably contacting CSIS. I mean, CSIS is a body where, again, I spent 15 years there, that does counterterrorism investigations. Did CSIS, did it come across their radar in investigations? Did the RCMP know anything about him? The OPP has a very small anti-terrorism section. Again, I worked there in 2015. I retired from CSIS. Do they have anything? So they're going to want to cross all the T's, dot all the I's. The other thing, Rob, that your listeners should appreciate, if he's charged with terrorism and he's found guilty, there's no difference in the sentencing between that and first-degree murder. It's the same sentencing. If he's found guilty of murder and it's a hate crime, as I said earlier, then the judge has an actual a window to increase the sentence that is imposed on it. But for terrorism, he does not.
Yeah. The prime minister, as some of the opposition leaders pointed to, this is, you know, part of the reason why we classified groups like the Proud Boys as a terrorist organization. What do you think about that, labeling, say, the so-called far-right groups as terrorist organizations?
If the label warrants, I've got no problem with it. I was involved in the first listing of Al-Qaeda way back in 2002, believe it or not.
Okay.
But I also know, and I put this on my website, Rob, I know for a fact, and I've had this from very confirmed sources, that when the Proud Boys was suggested by the government as a terrorist organization, the security service pushed back and said, we don't have enough information to justify that listing. And yet it was listed anyway. So, you know, listings is very much a political tool, I find. It does help in certain ways, in certain prosecutions, for instance. But let's not turn the listings regime into something that politicians are going to use for political purposes. And I think for the Proud Boys, that was a classic example. That was a knee-jerk reaction to the attack on the Capitol on January the 6th. I don't think they're a terrorist group. I think they're probably
in Washington.
A far-right group.
In Washington.
Yeah. I think they're probably a far right group.
Yeah.
Are they a terrorist group? Well, if someone can point to an actual act of terrorism they carried out, I'd love to see it because I haven't seen it yet. I'm not dismissing them. They're not a bunch of guys I want with my neighbors. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. You're not inviting them over for a barbecue and some beers,
I'm not.
Right?
Yeah. But I'm not saying they're a terrorist group. Are they a hate group? Maybe. Are they a far right group? Probably. You know, again, I'm not trying to mince words here, but I mean, it's important that we do this properly.
Yeah.
And let me throw something else out, Rob.
Yeah.
You know, if they lay terrorism charges and they can't prove beyond reasonable doubt that it was an act of terrorism versus first degree murder, does the case fall apart?
Right.
Do they lose the case?
Right.
Again, so if you're the Crown, you want to win, right? You don't go to court to lose.
Yeah.
So the Crown's going to say, what is the best option we have? Alexandre Bissonnette in Quebec City was not charged with terrorism. He was found guilty of 6 counts of first-degree murder. Alec Manassian was not charged with terrorism. The guy out in Edmonton back in 2017 who hit the cop outside of Commonwealth Stadium had the ISIS flag on the dashboard. He was not charged with terrorism. He got 29 years for 5 counts of attempted murder. So I get the, again, as I said before, I get the emotional appeal of wanting to call it terrorism.
Okay.
But from a purely prosecution perspective, you don't necessarily have to go down that road to get the exact same result.
Okay. Very interesting. Phil Gursky, thank you so much. It's always so great to get your insight on these matters. Thank you again.
The pleasure is mine, Rob. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. President and CEO, Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, that's Phil Gursky. We'll be right back from that into another serious issues and the opposition parties passing a motion. There were abstentions by the cabinet yesterday, members of the Liberal cabinet. It called on the Liberal government to end court challenges against two key rulings on compensation for Indigenous children. So we're going to get into that, what played out, the language, the cases with Charlie Angus, the New Democrat member of Parliament. That's coming right up right here on The Rob Snow Show on City News.
He's the opinionated Ottawa icon.
The Rob Snow Show returns
on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
So MPs from all parties joined the New Democrats and called on the federal government to drop legal battles against a pair of rulings involving First Nations children. So to walk us through some of the background behind this, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the Rob Snow Show New Democrat MP Charlie Angus. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, it's very nice to hear from you. The news has been rather depressing of late, but we must discuss it nonetheless. Tell me the history behind this motion. The passed 271-0, but the cabinet abstained yesterday.
Yes. Well, in this goes back to the Human Rights Tribunal ruling of 2016 that found the government was guilty of, quote, willful and reckless discrimination against First Nation children in two areas. One is in health services, because unlike folks, kids and grandkids who go to the hospital, they're under the provincial system. Indigenous kids on reserve are paid through the feds.
Okay.
And the feds simply refuse to pay for all manner of basic services that children in the provincial system took for granted. So that's a thing called Jordan's principle, that the feds can't sit and argue about who's going to pay for a child's health because children die. And the other is the broken child welfare system, where kids are disappeared into these broken foster homes, and the Indigenous kids get way, way less support, and many more of them die. So that was the ruling. And 2016, Justin Trudeau says, I recognize the ruling. We're going to work with the government, blah, blah, or the ruling. 19 non-compliance orders later, millions of dollars spent on lawyers, and Justin Trudeau is still fighting in court. So yesterday, Parliament told him, hey, just stop it. We have to start addressing these issues and stop fighting point by point. We need to get the rights and dignity of Indigenous kids. We got to just recognize that it's got to get done.
Okay. How does the issue of financial compensation work into the whole thing, Mr. Angus?
Well, the original ruling was not about financial compensation, and this is what the government's arguing. They're saying this is unfair. You're making us pay.
But I thought it said that First Nations children who were separated from their families, because of the underfunded welfare system, were entitled to $40,000, $50,000 in compensation.
Yeah, the ruling has been on $40,000. But
okay.
It's really important for people to know is that the original ruling didn't talk about compensation. It talked about the government fixing it. But after 19 non-compliance orders, the Human Rights Tribunal said this is the worst case we've ever seen of someone being found guilty and absolutely refusing to do the right thing. So this, the maximum penalty is $20,000 to $40,000. So the Human Rights Tribunal imposed that on the federal government because they hadn't done anything. So now that, of course, has given the government the chance to say this is outrageous. How dare you? And they're also saying something I think really insidious. They're saying we want to hear from the children, meaning they want to bring all these kids to court and make them testify and question them like they did the St. Anne's residential school survivors to prove that they've had their lives ruined. I'm sorry. If you've been taken from your family at age 4 and put in the foster care system, your life's been pretty buggered up. Those are the facts. We wouldn't be talking about compensation if the government had done the right thing. And the longer they wait, I think the more they're going to be facing from class actions and other lawsuits.
Okay. What is, you know, a lot of us are, we're trying to play catch up on a lot of these issues. And certainly what has happened in Kamloops is kind of jarred us all and put it all right in front of us. And we have to familiarize ourselves with a lot of things. For example, I know a little bit more about the Jordan rule, which is more about the timing of a trial and how there has to be a speedy trial. Totally different from what's known as Jordan's principle.
Yes.
So what is Jordan's principle? Yeah, when it comes to First Nations children, can you explain what Jordan's principle is?
Well, Jordan's principle is named after a little boy named Jordan River Anderson, who lived and died in a hospital bed because the federal government refused to pay for his treatment to go home. Any other child in that hospital, they would have moved him to his house and they would have gotten some support. But the Fed said no. Once he's out of the hospital, we're not paying. So the rule was, you can't let a kid live and die in a hospital bed because you're fighting with the province. So the Jordan's principle is put the needs of the child first.
Okay.
So one of the things they were found guilty on recently was that we lost a bunch of little, very young kids in Wapakika Reserve. And the community was begging the government. They had this program in place. The government cut the funding. They were saying, like, kids are going to die if we don't get this back up and running. And the government argued that it was their decision. They could make the decision when or they would pay or not. And the ruling was, I'm sorry, when a kid's life is at risk now, you have to turn around within 24 hours and say why you are going to support or not. Like that, it put timelines on the government that had never been there before. And it was because kids have literally died while government lawyers have argued. So that's Jordan's principle. Let's put the health of these kids first, and then you can argue jurisdiction with the provinces after. But the kids
provide the resources to the children, and then bicker amongst yourselves whether the bill is actually covered by the federal government or the provincial government.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
That is the fundamental of it.
Okay. So doing reading the news reports. A former residential school that keeps coming up in the news is St. Anne's. What was St. Anne's? Why is that in the news media all the time?
Well, St. Anne's is notorious for the torture and abuse of children. I mean, they used to strap kids to an electric chair as a kick for the staff that worked there. Little 5-year-olds being tortured in an electric chair.
No way.
Kids who were raped, assaulted, killed. And when the St. Anne's survivors went as part of these hearings that were set up under Prime Minister Harper, there were 10,000 pages of police evidence of crimes committed in that school. And the survivors went into the hearings and the government lawyer said, oh, there's no record of any crimes here. Oh, there's no record to prove that priest was here when you said he was. And they threw out all these cases. And, you know, if you go to court and someone suppresses evidence for the case, that lawyer gets disbarred. If the Justice Department does it, well, you've got Carolyn Bennett who's going to back them up. So that's the issue with St. Anne's, is that the government needs to deal with the fact that they lied in these hearings. They suppressed the evidence of horrific brutality. They need to sit down with these survivors and figure out a solution. And they've refused to do that. So that was part of the motion yesterday, is just do the right thing.
Okay. So that was in Fort Albany, Ontario, it says.
Fort Albany, yes.
Yeah, which is near Casseshawan, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Northern Ontario. So what are the ramifications then of this motion, given that it passed overwhelming, unanimously here, 271 to nothing, but again, the cabinet abstained. So what does that mean? What impact could that have, do you think?
Well, I think it has huge impact on the Trudeau government, because Justin Trudeau won, I think, largely in 2015, because people believed he was going to make things right with First Nation people.
Yeah.
The fact that Justin Trudeau skipped the vote, he wasn't even there. What used to be his most important relationship, now he skips out. In 2 weeks, or in a week, they go back to federal court against the children. And if Justice Department lawyers are in court in a week, people are going to say, wait a minute, Parliament ordered you to do the right thing. They ordered you to sit down and negotiate a solution. I think it's going to be really, really difficult for the Trudeau government to get away with this, because even the Liberal backbench broke ranks. The fact that the Liberal backbench would not support the government position shows that the Liberal MPs get this is, you can't treat kids like this. You can't, go total brass knuckles against little kids or against residential school survivors. So it's going to be a real moral test for the government if they figure they could ignore the call of Parliament. I don't know if there's a legal ability to call them in contempt of Parliament. I don't know if we have those tools, but we certainly have the moral tools to say Parliament ordered you to do the right thing because you weren't going to do it on your own. But if you continue to fight in court, I think it's going to really damage. Well, I think the courts aren't going to be all that favorable to them.
Okay.
But it's certainly going to damage this prime minister even more. And he's taken a lot of hits. Why is he doing this? I just don't get it.
What more do you think could be done to put pressure on church officials?
Well, this is a big thing. All the churches that were involved in the residential schools, they made the formal apologies and they paid reparations. And they got off scot-free, because considering, if these went to massive lawsuits, they would have all been out of business. The problem was that the Catholic Church walked away on the money it owed. The Catholic Church ran the biggest institutions and some of the most notorious institutions. I say that I came out of the Catholic schools. I came out of the Catholic community, but they've never taken responsibility. They've never turned over the documents they're supposed to. It's like the sex abuse cases in the United States. They put the big wall of silence. I don't think they're going to be able to get away with that either. People want this thing figured out. People are horrified. We know there's going to be many mass graves found. So let's acknowledge it. Let's try and get the names of these children. Let's get the apology. Canadians expect this. This is the least Canadians expect. So my message to Justin Trudeau and to the Catholic Church is time to step up to the plate, boys, and do the right thing.
Thank you, Charlie Angus.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah,
so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
the MP for Timmins, James Bay, New Democrat, Charlie Angus. That's it for the Rob Snow Show. The news next, then the Mark Sutcliffe Show on City News.
The Rob Snow Show.
Weekdays 9 to noon on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
Number one for local news in Ottawa and the Valley.